Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm John Michelson. Find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com, like us on Facebook, follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson, and follow us at Green Connects DC. We are here live at the Green Biz Verge 2014 conference in beautiful downtown San Francisco. And today, right now, I am joined with Nihal Desai, who is Global Business Director of Dow Water and Process Solutions. Welcome to Green Connections.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you. So, first of all, what does Dow Water and Process Solutions do? I mean, most people don't really think of a company like Dow having this kind of a function, perhaps. I mean, you're a chemical company and you've got a lot going on, obviously, but to have a department that's just dedicated to water?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you think about Dow, you would maybe traditionally think of them as a chemical and plastics company, but it's fundamentally material science and technology. And when you think about advanced separation and purification, that requires a lot of chemistry, a lot of science, a lot of physics to be able to develop technologies that can handle the most challenging waters. And so we've been involved with providing those types of technologies to the marketplace for well over 60 years. And we've just continued to build on that, really, with looking at the trends out in the marketplace and then where could our approach to developing new and robust technologies play a role and helping tackle some of these really big problems. So it's the direction of where Dow is going and has been going for several years toward more market-oriented, market-facing, advanced approaches to solving real big problems in the world.
Well, water is obviously an enormous issue on the planet right now. But companies like Dow are frankly responsible for a lot of the toxicity. So how are you helping your colleagues at Dow detoxify the water that is being used? I mean, when you process chemicals, you're putting chemicals into the water, okay, just as a sort of follow logic, right? I mean, so one of the issues with fracking, for example, is the chemicals that go into the water. So it's not just water purely. So how does a chemical company manage its own issues around trying to not have toxins go into the water?
Well, I think first and foremost, as an operating company, you know, we operate with a complete focus on making sure that we're not doing any damage to the environment in which we operate. So, I mean, we live in the cities in which we produce. So it's not in anybody's interest to turn around and do something it's not in anybody's interest, for sure, to do anything incorrectly. And so over the years, I would argue that Dow and companies like Dow have led the way in developing new approaches to treating very challenging waste treatment systems. And you know, when you talk about chemicals, I mean, I think that's, quite honestly, an unconventional and relatively uninformed view, simply because, as you said at the beginning, I wouldn't have thought of Dow as being into the water treatment business. Well, actually, we have been for many years, and the specific thing that my team is working on and what our business works on is not chemicals. We're talking about physical filtration. We're talking about being absolute barriers to contaminants. So if you think about reverse osmosis, which is a technology that's been around for a while, Dow's the leader in that technology. That is a chemical-free process for being able to physically filter out contaminants, salts, you name it, from the water that's coming in to be able to create a purified stream on the other end.
That's potable.
That's potable, correct. And so when you think, again, broadly, those are technologies that not only have been developed and commercialized by Dow, but we also utilize those technologies in our own operations to make sure that we are meeting and in many cases exceeding what we need to do to be able to make sure that our footprints and handprint are both completely in alignment with what makes sense in the communities we operate in. So we operate in places like Michigan, which has a different set of water challenges than, say, in Texas, which is different than, you know, the Netherlands, which is different than China. I mean, we operate all over the world. So that learning also helps inform some of our own understanding of, for example, what does an industrial company need from a solutions perspective to continue to battle this vice that they're in, you know. And I say industrial companies, but we're all in that vice. Incoming water is getting worse, or in some cases not at all available. outgoing requirements have continued to rise in terms of how clean do you have to have it. And then ultimately, we all are still trying to meet this insatiable demand for stuff. And therefore, you need more water, typically, to make more stuff. I mean, that's just practically the one connection that we always see. And so a lot of companies now are getting very aggressive. And how do they reuse water? How do they become more efficient with the water that they have? And again, those are places where we have working examples of that within Dow on how we're getting at that problem. But then we can use those examples to people on the outside to say, well, here's how you might want to consider it. And we happen to have also invested in these technologies to help enable those types of approaches.
I mentioned fracking, and obviously water, there's this huge energy water nexus. Right? What are the technologies that Dow is using to help remove some of the contaminants that go in the water from fracking so that it doesn't end up permeating the consumable water and the water that communities use?
Well, I think there's a couple of approaches. It's a good question because we are active in that space. There's a couple of things to think about. First of all, you have the fresh water that's required, or at least has been required in the past, to be able to start the process. In those cases, we've been involved with either treating the water that was being used in a manner that made that an efficient and effective hydraulic fracturing job. But probably the most important thing that's going on right now is not so much the water that's being used to start the process. It's the amount of water that comes up after the fact.
Right.
I think that it's something that's not as well known that, you know, for every gallon or so that you're using to develop that well, you're generating possibly 10x that amount over the life of the well coming back up. This is water that's trapped under the ground that has not been actually accessed and has actually more stuff in it. And this is naturally occurring stuff, so it's not anything that's been added, but it has a lot of hydrocarbons in it. Hydrocarbons that, when in water, can cause a problem once they come to the surface. This is almost as if you were drilling a well, not even doing anything related to hydraulic fracturing. Some of these constituents sit in our Earth's shell, right? So we have these physical filtration approaches as well as media that allows you to pull out contaminants. And we're working with companies right now. They say, okay, well, the water's coming back up. It has oil in it. It has various kinds of stuff. Again, nothing to do with the fracturing fluid.
Well, but also has the chemicals from the fracture.
It does, but I mean, when you consider the amount in there, the fracturing fluids actually are now no longer the big player in that. It's sort of the naturally occurring things that you don't want to have coming up. And so you can actually take multi-step approaches to being able to treat that water all the way to the point where you could discharge to environment, to the environment at a state that is cleaner than the typical groundwater you would have been trying to use in the first place. We have a great example of that going on in Wyoming, where there is a oil and gas company, Encana, where they have these old oil wells that have been out there for decades, right? Well, at the end of life of a typical oil well, it's pumping 10x more water than any oil that's coming up. And the whole thing is driven by economics, right? The price of oil high enough, they'll go after it, but then they have to deal with all that water. And what they realized is that rather than just dealing with the water, they said, why don't we treat it? Treat it in a very arid part of the United States, where if we can provide that water back to the community, whether it's for agricultural use or what we would call beneficial reuse, right? It's not for drinking, but there's so many other things that we do. Might we actually be tapping into something that we never really had the economic reason to go after?
That also allows you to build a partnership with the community, if you will.
Absolutely. So what they did is they have a demonstration project that is allowing them to take the water that's coming up from these wells. They treat it through a multi-step process all the way to the point where they're taking out not only the particles and other things that would be in there, but they're taking out, you know, trace-level contaminants to the point where the quality of that water is such that they can discharge it. It can create new streams. It can create new aquifer recharge. It could do a lot of things, right? Well, there's an opportunity there now, more so than ever, to be able to tackle that water challenge, because it's water that we've typically looked at and gone, I don't know what to do with that.
Well, you still have to be careful because you said it's not drinkable. And so, you know, if people naturally in a community in their home, they get water coming out of the faucet or coming into their shower, you know, that's going to go in your mouth at some point. So you have to...
Absolutely.
There's a huge education component there.
Absolutely.
You know, it just doesn't seem realistic to say that we can use it in all these other ways, but no,
well,
it's
no,
not
it's
drinkable.
Absolutely realistic. And if you look at what's going on in communities around the world, first of all, two things. If everybody wants to do everything they've ever done without thinking about it, then we have a problem.
Right.
Behavior change is where this all starts. And the fact is that even in LA, they're talking about dual metering. Well, what is really dual metering about? Different water goes onto your lawn than goes into your house. We treat all of our water in the United States drinking water standard, but how much of it does it really mean, how much of that really is going into drinking water? Do you really need drinking water standard to clean your car? And why are you cleaning your car when you could go to a place that is that's a wash, and you can go to a car wash where they recycle all the water there, right? When you sit there and think about, well, where are the other laundry? Do I really need drinking water standard water in my laundry machine, in my washer? I probably don't. So I think in principle we have to rethink our relationship with water, because other places in the world where they are in very dire straits have done that. You have buildings in India where they have, you know, apartment building, 5-story high. They want to build a 10-story high building. The local regulators say, well, great, but you can only have the water that you have for a 5-story building. You have twice as many people. What are they doing? They're locally recycling gray water. The water that comes out of your washing, that comes out of your sinks, your toilets, a number of places. And when you think about using that as its own loop, it doesn't touch the drinking water side.
Right? So it goes only through the plumbing.
Yeah, so you now are talking about some very different ways of thinking about it. But, you know, I mean, if you look at Orange County, they have one of the most successful water reuse facilities in all of the world. But their whole point of that is that you're taking water that has gone through all kinds of uses. They treat it tremendously well with a bunch of advanced technologies, including membranes that our company makes. But then their intention isn't to have you just drink it. They maybe will use it to then maybe recharge an aquifer, which, by the way, through natural processes, it's how the water got there in the first place. It does a natural job of removing contaminants over time, right? So you can use nature as well as technology to kind of help us start to close the loop on a lot of things. So think about all the water that's just once through.
Are you using that? That reminds me, there's some movement now about using naturally occurring animals, if you will, I mean, they're microbes, really, to decontaminate water. There's a word for it that escapes me at the moment.
Well, there's biomimicry, which we heard today at the conference, right? A lot of great examples of how we look at nature and how it deals with certain problems. And then either you find a way to synthetically develop a similar approach. But, you know, fundamentally, when you look at wastewater treatment, we rely on bugs.
Well, that's, yeah, there's a
bugs,
there's
actually,
like an aquamarine bug, and it's
there's several kinds. I mean,
yeah.
It's an interesting scientific area where you need to know what's in the water before you can then apply the appropriate natural systems to be able to tackle the problem.
Well, as I recall, it was part of what helped clean up from the BP oil spill was that I think Kevin Costner's company, a small company that he started, came in with a naturally occurring, it was like a seaweed kind of product that helped eat up the oil from the water, which helped extract the oil faster, which saved a lot of the potential destruction.
Well, and I think generally the category that you're talking about, the Nature Conservancy and Dow actually have a pretty unique partnership where we're thinking about things and we call it ecosystem services, and the idea being is where can you actually leverage nature in its ability to help us solve some of these problems. So rather than investing in a state-of-the-art, very expensive water treatment facility for dealing with waste, how can you use natural wetlands, which are traditionally used for those kinds of things, build the wetland to be able to actually perform the natural process of cleanup rather than artificially injecting sort of cement and all that to do it. And we've got a great example of that down in Texas right now. But that thinking is critical, because while we're talking about solving problems, you're also talking about rejuvenating the ecosystem while you're doing it. And so that's some of the thinking that we're doing today and implementing today, with the idea that we have to show examples. And who better than companies that have both a social and an economic imperative to find different ways to tackle the problem? I was talking about this earlier today. We have a great partnership in the Netherlands where our facility was needing more water. The local municipality was challenged with their water system and investment and what was happening. They needed to upgrade it. So through a unique partnership between the two, we're taking the municipal outflow, so the waste treatment outflows from the city. We're using that water instead of drawing from the fresh water. We're using their water, treating it, using it in our plant three times. And then we're discharging it at a rate, and we're now discharging it into the community as a clean stream. And what did that do? It took the pressure off of the fresh water, which both the ag guys and the community needed. We didn't go to desalinating. We didn't go to the ocean in that particular case because we had this other source that was enormously valuable and lower cost for us to deal with.
Well, it's a recycling, if you will.
And it's a recycling. And that's why, you know, when we think about the hierarchy of how we tackle these problems, efficiency is definitely a big place and the place to start. Use less. Use it more efficiently.
This goes to the
reuse.
Right, exactly. And this goes to the water risk issue. I mean, one of the things with climate change and is the water risk as well. How do these technologies intersect with that? How do they ultimately reduce the water risk both from contaminants as well as from drought? Because, you know, I mean, look, we're in California, okay?
Sure.
So there's a huge need there. But, I would, you know, so many companies need to and communities need to deal with this risk to water in general.
I think it's there's several ways. I mean, as I talked about, I think the very first step is around efficiency and reducing, right? So in the industrial sense, there's an economic imperative to do that. Using less water, and depending on the cost of it, you can do the math and you can say, wow, that's the right thing to do, just use less. But for the consumer, now you have a very different context because you want them to use less, but what's the incentive to use less? Other than the fact that maybe it's priced differently and now they have a reason. But what we start to see in that case is because you can't affect that change, we get into things like rationing and allocations and strong wording from the city saying, please don't water your lawn or don't wash your cars. Now,
and people panic about that because it's scarcity.
Yeah, it's scarcity. But then you then get all the way back to what I said before, which is, but are we then taking advantage of the flows that are already in our system to get the maximal use out of them? So to what effect are we actually tapping into recycle streams? How are we reusing the water that we have? I mean, think about the water that mostly ends up in Southern California. It came from somewhere else. It's not happening right there. So once it gets to you, are you using it 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times? If you do that, now you're actually starting to become delinked a bit from, I always need to have new fresh sources, I always need to have fresh sources. And ultimately, once you've exhausted those kinds of avenues, then you turn to things like creating new water sources. That's where desalination, for example, can come in. But it's not the first place you would start. You got to do all the other stuff. And then you actually move on to desalination, which can help you create a renewable stream of water supply, but only as it relates in context of those other things that I just mentioned. And so that's how you start to tackle it. And then the technologies have to be robust. They have to be reliable. And then over time, they have to become more and more efficient. And that's where I think, you know, we've seen a lot of movement over the last 10, 15 years on those factors, reliability, really making them efficient from an energy point of view. Because we always talk about this water-energy nexus, but without energy, you don't have water and vice versa.
Right,
so
right.
You have to work on trying to crack that code.
So two quick things in closing. One is I also have heard about companies who are doing fracking who are recycling the water within the fracking system.
Mm-hmm.
So the water that they take in, they're running through the fracking process, but then they're using the water, that, as you say, 10x, that comes out the other side for the next process instead of taking in any new water for the next time over.
Yes, that's exactly happening. It's happening in the middle of the country. It's been happening in the Marcellus up in the Northeast for quite a while. And part of this is, you know, we call it, there's a smart way to do this, right? There's the roughshod way of going after tapping into this enormously valuable, powerful energy source, but then there's this the responsible way to do that, and that responsibility includes very much what you just said, which is you have to find a way to reduce the freshwater intake and aggressively recycling, both for your own use, potentially for another company's use near you, or to then provide it back into the general pool community for other uses where it would be appropriately the right quality, right?
Right.
Those are things that actually start to really say, gosh, we're harnessing not only the energy, but we're actually responsibly managing the water that we now have in a way that gets us somewhere that we weren't before.
Right, and you're making the community think about how they use water differently. In closing, there's a movement now to raise the price of water.
Yeah.
That the theory being that, you know, we pay, to say pennies on the dollar is the understatement even, for water. And so it's just, you know, it's like water, you know.
Right.
One can run it, you know, whatever. And that's a problem because water is in great scarcity right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the scarcity pushes up against basic survival, okay?
Sure.
And I think there are a lot of people in Western countries particularly who just don't want to deal with the risk to water because it's too scary.
Mm-hmm.
They want to turn on the, you know, there's a comfort in turning on the faucet knowing it's going to come out, you know? And thinking that might not happen is so overwhelming and so discomforting that they just want to block it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movement to raise the price on water is to help elevate the value of water,
mm-hmm.
so that people treat it almost more like gold. I mean, in some parts of the world, as you well know, it's, and you sort of alluded to, it is gold.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about that. Where does Dow come down on raising the price of water, and how would that work?
Well, I don't think we have a particular view on how to do it and where to do it. That's really a very fundamental policy question. But what I will tell you is that in many communities, there is a disconnect between the actual value of it. And I don't mean the price you pay, but what else, what are all the other things it does for you? What other economy is it driving? I mean, I get the point about you as a person that you have the scary feeling about, wow, I'm not going to have water. But do you have that same scary feeling about, I'm not going to have my cell phone, I'm not going to have cable? Because frankly, you're paying a lot less for water than you're paying for cable. Would you trade it off? If given those choices, I think people will make those choices because that's how important it is. And in other parts of the world where that is already their reality, they're making those choices. They're like, you know, if you think about it, if you have an extra dollar in your pocket in the American market right now, you might consider buying the new iPhone 6, right? If you have an extra dollar in your pocket and you're sitting in a part of the world where water is just a big, big issue and you can't trust that the water coming out of the well or out of the pipe is clean for your family, you're going to buy a water purifier. You're going to buy something that says it's going to be the level of quality that it needs to be to keep my family safe. Now, they're talking about a price of water on a relative basis much more than we're talking about the price of water. But it's all your context. It's the urgency of needing to make a choice. And I think in some of the communities in the United States, that urgency is upon us. And I think choices are being made. Choices either by the public policy that says, here's how we have to make this choice because it's the collective good, or in some cases, they're private decisions that are being made by individuals on trying to recapture their own rainwater and trying to be more efficient in how they manage the water in their home. But I think those are choices that it's not about the price of water, but it is the value of water,
and then
appropriately calculating that value in the context of all the other choices that you have to make.
Right, but in the 21st century, in many ways, I mean, value is determined by price, is enumerated, if you will, by price. I mean, that
if
is
you don't do the math.
The origin.
That's right.
The origin of currency is to put a value on something, you know, weighted value, if you will.
Yeah.
It reminds me, when I lived in San Francisco many, many years ago, we actually had to ration water as well. So I can relate to that experience. Just in closing, an example, I don't know if you're involved in this, but Coca-Cola partnered with Dean Kamen and a global organization to bring in these small water purifiers that are about the size of a toaster to into Africa to help women in particular who carry the water, to help them purify the water that they collect. And while they're in the facility where they're purifying the water, they can also charge their cell phone and watch international news. And all the facilities are run by women, which A, makes the women feel safer, obviously, and also empowers women entrepreneurs for their 5x20 program. So I don't know if you're involved in that at all, but it seems like an example of what you're talking about, where there are third world countries that need to value water and are doing it in unique ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I applaud the work that Coca-Cola is doing. I mean, they're a business partner of ours on many fronts, and we actually just welcomed them into the fold of another venture that we have been supporting for the last several years called Water Health International, where that principal idea is that we're talking about water treatment technology kind of in a package that can be dropped into communities in the developing world to allow them to become more self-sufficient in a decentralized way. So they're not really banking on somebody else to treat the water and pipe it to them. They're taking care of their issues right where they are. They have a unique financing model to then essentially create local entrepreneurs that have created a water business, right? So, but it's a water business where people can come up with jugs and containers and fill them up and pay a little bit of money. It's microfinancing at its best. And Coke just joined in as an investor in that company. And now they're thinking about moving into Africa. They've installed more than 500 systems in India, and now they're moving into Africa. But these kind of endeavors are happening in the idea of utilizing water as a means of economic development, because in communities where there's nothing, it really, I mean, people will pay. But you have to provide them with the infrastructure to do that. And I think this is why the conversation around microgrids for electricity, and if you will, microgrids for water, it's all about, can you do it somewhere locally such that you can now enable the communities? It's bringing the water to where people live, as opposed to shipping it to them, trucking it to them.
It also reduces the risk overall. I mean, and it eliminates the need to get all the bloviating policymakers involved.
Well, I mean, but so, you know, so the
it
thing...
It probably simplifies the process.
It does simplify the process, because you're then starting to tap into sort of your comment before. These are human needs and drivers. And so if some company comes in, whether it's Coca-Cola with their endeavor with Dean Kamen or what we're doing with Water Health International, you're landing solutions right where they need to be had, and then there's a natural attraction to it, right? And so in some communities, there are women that are being engaged in this because they've historically been a part of the water chain for families, going to the river, doing the laundry, or bringing it in for cooking or whatever they're doing. I mean, just the amount of time they're spending on the road. How do you just change that dynamic by enabling them with it's not super sophisticated technology. It's just that it's being put into the hands of people that now can take care of themselves.
Well, I mean, I've been in Africa and I've watched them carry it on their heads and stuff. It's pretty amazing. And I would also just throw out there that I think when you build these mini infrastructures, you're helping enable an infrastructure that can help other ways to provide economic development in those communities as well.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a great discussion.
Sure. Thank you.
I really appreciate your help. Snehal Desai of Dow Water and Process Solutions, Global Business Director. Thank you for joining us on Green Connections Radio. I'm Joan Michelson. Like us on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson. And follow us at Green Connects DC. We'll be right back with more from Verge 2014. Thank you very much.
Capital Audio Post, your one-stop shop for your post-production needs. 703-712-8757.
Our services include video editing, sound design, sound mixing, ISDN recording, and many other media-related services.
Let us finish your project no matter where you are, across the U.S. or across the world. Go to www.capitalaudiopost.com. Call us at 703-712-8757.
Let us know how we can help you finish your production.